Nothing is tastier than a soup made with real bone broth. But it's not just good for the taste.
This kind of broth and soup is good for people. And people have known this for centuries. We just lost touch with making real food the way they did 100 years ago. So this is basically just a return to real food. And we're finding that real food has a lot of nutritional benefit.
That's Catherine Harvey. She co-authored the Bare Bones Broth Cookbook, 125 gut-friendly recipes to heal, strengthen, and nourish the body. Then I read from my story, The Food Philosopher. And finally, we continue our Thanksgiving tradition with Native American scholar Marge Bruschak telling us the true story behind the holiday. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net, also at PRX. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Broth is one of the newer foodie trends these days, but it used to be the way broth was just made, the days before you bought some dried bouillon cubes or packaged stock in the store. Back then, the stock pot was always simmering on the back of the stove with its rich collection of scraps, both animal and vegetable. When you simmer bones for many hours, and we're talking 24 hours in the case of beef and poultry bones, what you get at the end is something that deeply nourishes both body and soul. And it's not just for soup, as my guest Catherine Harvey shows in the book she co-wrote with her husband Ryan Harvey, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook, 125 gut-friendly recipes to heal, strengthen, and nourish the body. In addition to soup, the book includes delicious recipes for main dishes and sides like chicken pot pie and carrot souffle. The Harveys say bone broth is great for our health, boosting immunity, aiding digestion, strengthening bones, and giving us better-looking skin, hair, and nails. And it could help us recover faster from injuries. Ryan and Catherine Harvey are the founders of the Bare Bones Broth Company, which sells artisanal bone broth to consumers online. Catherine Harvey, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Francesca.
Now, I found out about your book, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook, because I actually had broken my ankle. And I was looking for ways to speed up the healing if possible. And I came upon the whole notion that making your own bone broth can actually help with wound healing.
Absolutely. A lot of doctors are telling us the same thing. It's largely because bone broth is loaded with collagen and glucosamine, which, as you probably know, are supplements that a lot of people take for joint health and for bone health.
So how did you find out about this? And then tell us, how did you come to decide to do a cookbook about this with your husband, Ryan?
Well, it really all starts with Ryan. He's a classically trained chef. And one of the first things that he learned in culinary school is the value of a high-quality stock in cooking, because it adds a lot of body and flavor to practically any dish that you can make. And he couldn't figure out why this kind of stock wasn't available to consumers in the supermarket, so he wanted to figure out a way to package it and sell it to them, because most of the broths and stocks available in the store are made from a lot of sodium preservatives and MSG, and they don't have a lot of the ingredients and real food in them that a high quality stock does. So that's how he started making it. And he quickly realized, because he's kind of a nutrition buff, that st- stock made the homemade whey is also really good for you. So we started doing a little bit of research into why that might be. I'm a journalist, so I'm a researcher by nature, and I helped him sort of dig into some of the studies that showed why this kind of broth and soup is good for people. And people have known this for centuries. We just lost touch with making real food the way they did 100 years ago. So this is basically just a return to real food, and we're finding that real food has a lot of nutritional benefit.
Yeah. In fact, yesterday I heard somebody on NPR, I believe it was, a doctor talking about how she's beginning to give prescriptions out for food, not supplements, and not for medicine as well, but also for food. So tell us more about this. Your subtitle is 125 Gut-Friendly Recipes to Heal, Strengthen, and Nourish the Body. Gut-friendly?
Gut-friendly, yeah. You mentioned that a lot of doctors are starting to recommend food and nutrition in lieu of supplements and medicine, and that's really because they're recognizing the importance of food in our mental health and in our gut health, which affects our mental health. And that's been a topic that's on the rise in a lot of news stories, how the health of the lining in our digestive tract affects every other part of our bodies, especially our mental health. Because what they have found is when we eat foods that aren't good for us, they damage the lining of our digestive tract, and they pierce or eventually wear away tiny holes in your digestive tract. So what happens is when you eat foods, even foods that would be good for you otherwise, with a damaged gut lining, some of those foods are absorbed into your bloodstream before they're processed. And in that form, a lot of times they're toxic to us. And when those toxins get into your bloodstream, they make their way to your brain. And they can affect your mental health. It could cause everything from depression to fuzzy thinking to just weariness, fatigue. So doctors have found that bone broth, because it contains a lot of the nutrients that rebuild our bodies from the cell up, they found that they also repair our gut lining. Those nutrients do. So it rebuilds your gut and repairs it from all of the damage we've done with the junk foods that our society is known for eating.
So, Catherine Harvey, is this also related to the idea of providing a good environment for your microbiome, for the gut-friendly bacteria?
Absolutely. It all starts with the health of your gut. You want to have healthy, secure linings in your digestive tract so that everything you consume is processed and absorbed properly. So it starts there. And then once you have a healthy gut lining, then you can start repairing your microbiome with probiotics and prebiotics, which I know a lot of people are hearing a lot about. So it's sort of a twofer. You've got to have that healthy gut lining, and then you've also got to have a healthy regimen of probiotics and prebiotics.
And so it's not just the gut, though, because you talk about hair and nails and joints. Talk a little bit about the health benefits of bone broth for those.
Well, if you look at the nutrients in bone broth, it's like reading the back of a multivitamin bottle. So it's just loaded with stuff that's good for you. It's got, like I mentioned, the glucosamine, the hyaluronic acid, chondroitin sulfate, tons of electrolytes, calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, silicon, and collagen, and tons of amino acids. And if you think about it, when you're making a bone broth, you're taking, in the case of Bare Bones, our bone broth company, we're taking the bones of healthy animals and we're simmering them for 24 hours. And in that simmer process, we are unlocking all of the nutrients from those bones. Those nutrients were the building blocks of life for the animal that those bones carried. And so we're unlocking those nutrients so they're in a bioavailable format for human consumption. So you're really transferring the building blocks of life from one being to another. And that sounds very spiritual, but that's really effectively what we're doing. And that's why those nutrients are so good for our bones and our skins and our joints and our hair, of course. So the nutrients just go to build the cells that make for a healthy human.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Catherine Harvey about the book she co-authored with her chef husband, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook. Now, you mentioned 24 hours. Talk a little bit about the best way to make a bone broth, and why so long, and how do you draw these nutrients out?
Start at 24 hours because that's the way that bone broth has been made traditionally for centuries. For a while, we were simmering the bones for up to 48 hours because we thought we could extract more nutrients from the bones that way. But what we found through testing is it really it didn't affect the amount of nutrients or the concentration of nutrients simmering them at an additional 24 hours. So we simmer them for 24 hours because, as you know, bones are pretty dense, and you want to give them plenty of time to release the nutrients into the water, which is what you're starting with. You take these healthy animal bones, you cover them with water, and then you simmer gently for 24 hours. We try never to bring the broth to a boil because when you bring it to a boil, it emulsifies. A lot of times fat and other impurities will come out of the bones as well. So you don't want to emulsify those into the broth. You want to skim those off the top, which is why we do a gentle simmer. And then toward the end, we add vegetables and herbs they're essentially for flavor, but they can augment the nutritional benefits of the bone broth as well. And what you end up with after 24 hours is they call it Jewish penicillin. Your grandma probably recommended chicken soup for you when you were sick. So that's what you end up with. It's anti-inflammatory. It's nourishing. It is the very definition of a nutrient-dense food.
Now, you talked about toxins. An awful lot of animals are raised with antibiotics and are, you know, raised in feedlots. Talk about the kind of animals. And, of course, this is a trigger warning for vegetarians.
Yeah, absolutely. This is why it's so important to start with very healthy animals who are raised properly. Because you are, anything that they ate or consumed, you're drawing out of the bones when you're simmering. So at Bare Bones, we use only grass-fed beef bones and pasture-raised organic chicken bones. This gives us the assurance that they weren't consuming antibiotics and growth hormones and all of the nasty things that have made their way into our food system. So it's really important that you start with healthy animals because those things that animals consume can cause them to be sick, which of course means that they could also cause us to be sick.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Catherine Harvey. Her book is The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook. She co-wrote it with her husband, Ryan Harvey, 125 gut-friendly recipes to heal, strengthen, and nourish the body. It can be pretty hard to find animals that are raised without antibiotics. I mean, for example, I go to my local chicken farm where the animals are free range, but I'm pretty sure they're not organic. Is it actually harmful to use them, or is it just not quite as good?
It can be. If you're consuming free range, you're probably in the clear. The reason it's hard to certify free-range animals organic, and this is the same reason that our grass-fed beef bones are not certified organic, when the animals are roaming freely and eating what they want, it's really tough to verify that they're not eating something that was affected by GMO seed or some runoff from another farm. But usually those animals are consuming high-quality organic food. It's just very hard to verify and confirm. So that's why the free range and sometimes pasture raised are not certified organic. Hmm. But usually they are organic.
So now there's another thing about simmering this for a long time. Something you talk about in the book that you want to get is the gelatin. So why gelatin and what are the best bones to simmer?
That's a great question. The gelatin, the reason that you want to achieve gelatin with your bone broth is that gelatin is the most visible indication of the quality of your bone broth. I've talked a couple of times about collagen, and collagen manifests itself in the physical world as gelatin. So if your broth gels, it's pretty certain that it's loaded with collagen. And collagen is the nutrient that most people are the most familiar with in bone broth. So a really gelatinous bone broth has tons of that collagen, which all of us need for our skin health and for our hair and our joints. And then part of your question.
The best kinds of bones, because I've actually noticed a difference. I mean, most of the time if you go to the supermarket and you ask for, you know, soup bones, they give you shank bones, and I haven't really gotten a whole lot of collagen from them. You know, I ended up having to get knuckle bones, which were much more difficult to find. But I do have to say that my local chicken farm will give you chicken feet for free, and boy, do they have a lot of collagen.
Oh, that's great. You're very fortunate that they're giving them to you for free, because the chicken feet really are the best part of the chicken for extracting that collagen. And this is Ryan's bailiwick. He figured out that the best bones to use, because it's a very popular opinion that you should use like marrow bones, the shank bones that you talked about, to make bone broth. But Ryan recognized early on that it's the bones that have tons of connective tissue that yield the most collagen and gelatin as a result. So we use those knuckle bones that you talked about for our beef broth. And for the chicken broth, we use chicken feet, and a lot of times we'll use the frames, the back, which has a lot of collagen in it as well. Mm-hmm. First of all, you don't have to simmer them as long to extract the nutrients, because you have those, all of the ligaments and the connective tissue, which are softer and easier to extract nutrients from. And second of all, they just have more of those nutrients. A lot of people will ask us about do you use a lot of marrow in your broth? Well, not really, because that's not where the nutrients really are. If you want to consume marrow, just eat the marrow. But bone broth it's about using a part of the animal that you couldn't consume otherwise.
And also, it's fish are pretty good, too. Where do you get the fish?
Fish are really the best type of bone to use for a bone broth. We don't make a fish broth at Bare Bones currently, because we've had a tough time sourcing fish bones. But we did find a potential supplier. They're based in Seattle, but they're Alaska fishermen, and they wild catch their cod via line, and that's a big deal because they're not mass fishing with a net. So all of their fish are line caught, so they're not overfishing the ocean. And generally, the wild caught are a lot healthier fish than you'll find in a lot of farms. So fish can be tough. Sustainable fishing and finding sustainable fish, it can be really tough, which is one reason we haven't gone down that road yet at Bare Bones.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Catherine Harvey about the book she co-authored with her chef husband, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook. So you're really also, this isn't only about health, but it's also about sustainable food.
It definitely is. That's something that's really near and dear to our hearts. Ryan and I both, first of all, we're very committed to nutrition and caring for our bodies and just being responsible in taking care of ourselves, but also being responsible to the land and the resources the land provides for us. And unfortunately, our commercial food system has, for lack of a better word, pillaged the earth for the last 80 to 100 years. And we've gotten to this place where we use only the most desirable parts of a plant or an animal, and then we throw out the rest. And with such limited and precious resources, we should be finding ways to use the undesirable parts. To take a chicken and use only the breasts or only the thighs and throw the rest away, or to use that hen to lay eggs and then do nothing with it once it's past laying age or its ability to lay, is, we think, irresponsible. And we just want to be really responsible in respecting the animal and respecting the plants and getting the maximum use out of them so nothing is going to waste. And this is a way to extend the life and extend the effectiveness of our food system. Some of the origins of bone broth were that, in caveman days, they didn't know when their next meal was coming or where it was going to come from. So if they were able to slaughter an animal, they didn't let any piece of it go to waste. And they would, as a result, take those bones and simmer them to extract those nutrients and sort of stretch the life and nutrients of the animal as long as possible so that they could get fed. Bone broth was originally the poor man's food because they didn't know if they were going to be able to get a steak or a chicken breast anytime soon. Mm. It's just very important to us to be responsible with our food system. And it's great for us, actually, that a lot of these food operations have been throwing away the bones. It makes it cheaper for us to make our bone broth, although they're catching on and beginning to sell them at a premium, of course.
Yeah, I went to a place in New York City in the Chelsea Market, and they were selling bones, knuckle bones, for $4.99 a pound. And, you know, they're pretty heavy bones, and they're beef bones. It yeah. Quickly added up.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate. It used to be, we used to tell people it's a lot cheaper to make your own bone broth at home than to buy ours, but it's getting to not be that way anymore, unfortunately, because you do need a lot of bones to make a good batch of broth.
Yeah, how many do you need? I mean, how much do you need typically?
Our rule of thumb is to just. It's a ratio thing. So you take the bones and you put them in your stock pot and you just cover them with water. So it just really depends on the size of your stock pot.
Right. Now, you include a whole bunch of recipes, 125 recipes in this book. Mm-hmm. And they're not just for soup. They're for, you know, things like chicken pot pie and other things. I'm sure this is going to be a tough question, but give us a recipe that you've tried and that you really like.
I should say all of them, but probably my very favorite, and this is going to come as a surprise, is the carrot souffle from the cookbook, because when you're making the carrot souffle, there's a lot of leftover broth after one of the steps, and it makes for the most delicious drinking broth. You've kind of simmered the carrots in there with some butter, and then you don't need the broth concoction anymore, so you strain it off, and it is just so good to drink while you finish making the souffle.
Well, this is a terrific book. Is there anything to watch out for before we go, that, you know, a tip that maybe you didn't know when you started and that you discovered through the process?
The main tip, if somebody is going to be making bone broth at home, is just keep a close eye on it. because a 24-hour simmer is a long time, and we typically recommend that you simmer the broth uncovered, which means that the water you put over the bones initially is going to evaporate. So you have to keep an eye on things and keep adding water during the process as it sort of concentrates and reduces down. So that's the main tip. Just keep an eye on it. But there's no problem with leaving a pot of broth to simmer on the back of your stove. People've been doing it for hundreds of years. And I know a lot of people are a little nervous about that, but it really is perfectly safe as long as everything's covered with water.
And what about a slow cooker?
Slow cookers work fine, too. It's typically hard to find one that has a low enough setting to simmer the broth without it bubbling and emulsifying those fats and impurities back into the broth. But if you can find one that has a great low setting, then by all means, use it.
Well, Catherine Harvey, it's just been great to talk with you about your book, co-written with your husband, Ryan, The Bare Bones Broth Cookbook, 125 Gut-Friendly Recipes to Heal, Strengthen, and Nourish the Body. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Francesca.
Catherine Harvey of the Bare Bones Broth Company. To read an excerpt from the Bare Bones Broth Cookbook, go to writersvoice.net. Next up, the food philosopher. Stay tuned after the break.
Callos en los pies, mal aliento sale de mi boca, palabras de fetidez. Este pelo pica, barbacita perezosa. Soy una oruga que nunca muda en mariposa. No quiero que me vean, no quiero que me oigan. Quiero quedarme desconocido. No quiero que me vean, no quiero que me oigan.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Thanksgiving is a day for feasting with friends and family. One of the most memorable feasts I ever attended happened when I was living in southern France back in 2001. The French, of course, don't celebrate Thanksgiving, but there are always plenty of other occasions to celebrate with good food and wine. The feast in question was held in honor of the winter solstice at the home of my good friends Michel and his wife, who I call Magali in the story. They live in the ancient town of Apt, in a villa with a view of the town and the Luberon mountain range above it. The food was divine, the wine likewise, and the company convivial, and I ended up learning a profound lesson about the French art of living. I wrote up the experience in the story The Food Philosophe, or Food Philosopher, part of a longer memoir of my sojourn in Provence. I read a long excerpt from the story here, joined at the end by former Writer's Voice co-host Daisy Mathias, who plays the part of Magali. Please forgive my less-than-perfect French accent when I speak in the voice of Michel. It echoes perfectly in my mind, but alas, not so much on the tongue. I had arrived at Michel and Magali's house in Op 2 days ago, but my hosts had had little time for me. Magali had been preparing the elaborate decorations. Michel, a professional chef who cooked for private clients in the region, had spent much of the time at the stove or the chopping block, obsessed, like an alchemist in his study. I had hovered on the margin like an anthropologist, observing native rituals. He was a man of many sides and a checkered past. He didn't fit easily into any categories. For one, he'd spent close to a decade in prison during his youth. The details were never really clear, but it had something to do with the underworld gangs in Marseille. He would have looked the part, too, were it not for his warmth and ebullient nature. He had a street tough's body, all barreled and bandy-legged, and his temper could be fierce. The tenaciousness of his grudges was legendary. The one time I crossed him, it took a good deal of bowing and scraping on my part before he let me back into his good graces. Assiduous watering of the flower of friendship with viticultural gifts didn't hurt either. But it was worth it. Michelle has one of those hearts so capacious that it stretches its membrane to an overly fragile extent and can become all too easily pierced.
You are the one for me, for me, for me, formidable. You are my love, very, 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 very tall.
The day of the feast, the guests assembled around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The first to arrive was a wealthy couple that ran a local chambre d'hôte. The husband, a red-faced, voluble man, was retired from the plumbing fixtures trade. Within minutes of his entrance, he had already boasted that of every 3 bidets in France, one of them was his. His wife, a stylish woman with a nervous, squinting tic and clenched jaw, amused the company with her acerbic, witty patter. When the guests had all arrived, we sat down at our designated places. The company broke out of the starter line with champagne and canapés, then settled in for the long stretch. First, the entree, a traditional cream tart, this one of leek. It was followed by a simple salad seasoned with a perfect vinaigrette. Then came the meat dish, bouffard de marinière du Rhône, that is, beef marinated for 3 days and simmered in wine. I understood the marinière du Rhône, a kind of pun with marinated and sailors of the Rhône, but the word bouffard escaped me. Later I tried to find it in my French dictionary, but the closest match I could come up with was buffet, to guzzle or feed like an animal, a description, I suppose, of the kind of behavior the dish inspired, at least in me. Then the cheese course, camembert, oozing its arterial poison, and some locally made goat cheese, runny with age and topped with Herbe de Provence. The desserts followed, note the plural, butter cookies à la maison, chocolate tubes filled with Grand Marnier, apple compote, and homemade sugared almonds. The meal was topped off by coffee, followed by liqueur as a digestive tonic. After the successful conclusion of the meal allowed him to relax, Michel stood in front of the hearth, sipping his coffee. An expression of deep satisfaction wreathed his face. I joined him as he reflected on the event. "Do you know how it was all done?" he asked me, raising his bushy eyebrows in a rhetorical flourish as we toasted our backs at the fireplace, espresso cups in hand. I shook my head no. "It is a combination of the book, I never invent a recipe," he paused to underscore the interjection, stubby finger raised, "time and love. And of all these, the last is the most important." I always loved it when Michel regaled me with his philosophical observations. His views percolated in a pungent stew of anarchism, quasi-Buddhism, and evangelical Christianity. A combination that never ceased to intrigue me with its unexpected and always strong flavors. "Tell me more," I prompted him. "It is a pleasure to give, to share with others," he said as if it were self-evident. He paused and then continued. "But there is something else, the hidden part." "What's that?" "Ego." His beetle brows flew up to punctuate the remark. "Oh, yes," I concurred, although I wasn't sure where he was going. "There's always ego." Of course," he drawled archly. "I am no different than the others." We each took the glass of digestive tonic that someone handed us in passing. "When you start to cook for people that you don't really like all that much," Michel resumed, "you say, 'Aha, I'm going to show them.'" He seemed to be leading in the direction of a moral message, but I couldn't imagine what that might be. "What does that do to your cooking?" I asked him.
"It deteriorates it. I am, in fact, trying to punish the customer. My sentiment is, I'm going to show this jerk. But the jerk is me."
I chewed his comment over. He waited for me to digest it. "You're saying there's a spiritual lesson here about egotism?" I ventured finally.
"Yes," he answered. "Well, it is not just egotism. More precisely, it is a lack of love."
He thought for a moment.
"Of course, you cannot love everyone."
If you had to love all your guests, being a professional chef could get complicated. Balance was surely being called for here, a scaling back of spiritual expectations. But you can cook for people you don't love without this idea of showing them, punishing them with your expertise, as it were, can't you? I asked.
"Yes, but only after you have understood this phenomenon. When you've learned a little humilité."
Humility is a virtue. Gluttony is a sin. Paying my sinner's dues, I finally succumbed to the surfeit of food and drink. Soon after my talk with Michelle, the force of gravity propelled me to the living room couch, pinning me supine by the weight of my stomach. Once there, it was a long time before I could bend sufficiently to attain the requisite angle to get up. While resting there, I mulled over Michelle's comments. I wondered which religious tradition was reflected in his thinking about humility. It seemed more Buddhist than Christian, or maybe it came out of the place where all spiritual traditions meet, the place where long years of discipline and practice dissolve the ego with the enlightenment that mastery brings. Foodism, like Buddhism, is just one of many pathways to nirvana. Buddhism says that life is suffering, and comprehension of that truth is the prerequisite to true happiness. I have no dispute with this teaching, as it counsels the wisdom of acceptance, but is it not as true that life is pleasure and happiness reposes in its enjoyment? As long as a pleasure hurts nothing and no one, and particularly when it feeds the soul as well as the senses. The meal Michelle and Magali shared with me and the other guests was Epicurean, not in the self-indulgent, gluttonous sense of the term today, but in the spirit of Epicurus himself, the enjoyment of simple pleasures shared with friends. Michelle himself had a profound interest in the spiritual dimensions of food. He called it the philosophie d'alimentation. One morning, several months after our winter feast, Michelle, Magali, and I were breakfasting on some chewy fresh rolls from the market and Magali's homemade mulberry jam as the spring birds sang their little hearts out in the olive grove next to the patio. Michelle took up the theme again.
"You are what you eat," he stated with an air of inviting questions and comments.
"You mean biologically?"
No. I mean it spiritually. But it is not just what you eat, but more importantly, how you eat."
I mumbled encouragingly through my crumbs for him to continue.
"You pay attention. You add a little salt. You think about what you're eating. You see what I mean?"
Magali chimed in.
"Yes, because there are people who eat just to supply themselves with nourishment."
Michelle interjected.
"To fill themselves up?"
"They pay absolutely no attention. They eat anything."
"The consciousness disabled," Michelle snorted.
"Do you mean buffet?" I was proud to use this newly learned word. "Eating like an animal?"
"Voila."
He took out his tobacco pouch and began rolling a cigarette. "A lot of Americans eat like that," I said, thinking of my own guilt in that regard.
"Yes, and that's why you have the problem of obesity in America. C'est dramatique, and it's beginning to appear in France. At the school, you see this kind of espèce de merde of chocolate bar."
Magali inserted.
"McDo, too, with all the sugary drinks."
She was talking about McDonald's. I shook my head sadly.
I was thinking yesterday that here in France, people have it so good. The food, the good company around the table. Why do they want to do things the American way, especially the worst of it?
Well, it's very easily explained, Michel told me. It's because America is a myth, the American dream.
All the young people dream of going to America.
Of course, Michel exclaimed with sarcastic levity. All the children of the middle and upper classes want to take a tour of America. It's a must.
He pulled on his cigarette and blew an exasperated smoke ring into the air.
Well, they also go to learn the language.
They could go to England for that, I commented.
Now Michel laughed scornfully.
It's the same thing. In England, they eat like pigs.
He tipped his chair dangerously back and puffed another smoke ring.
Yeah, fish and chips, I joined him in derision. Oh,
he brought the chair's front legs down with a thud.
Now that's fantastique. The fish and chips are fantastic.
The mood became suddenly giddy. Magali waxed positively rhapsodic on American fare.
And you know, the hamburger and the hot dogs with sauerkraut and mustard, oh la la, that's also really good, from time to time.
Michel looked at me and shrugged his shoulders.
You see, en France, they cannot resist it. They love the hamburgers at McDonald's, and the French sandwiches totally lack imagination. It's always ham with butter, ham with butter.
His lips pursed a disdainful grimace.
You can't find a good sandwich here. It is not possible.
And so, sated with good food and conversation, and buoyed by the leaven of internationalist goodwill, we concluded our repast. Like a fine meal, Michel's lessons in the French art of gourmandise required time to savor and digest. I've come back to them again and again, catching myself wolfing down my fare, already living in the next instead of the present moment, or stuffing myself with an over-large portion set in front of me, ensnared in the illusion that quantity is equivalent to quality. Then I imagine Michel looking at me from under his beetle brows with an expression of amused remonstrance, and I slow down to taste what I'm taking in.
À 18 ans, j'ai quitté ma province, bien décidé à empoigner la vie. Le cœur léger et le bagage mince, j'étais certain de conquérir Paris. Chez le tailleur le plus chic, j'ai fait faire ce complet bleu qui était du dernier cri. Les photos, les chansons et les orchestrations ont eu raison de mes économies. Je me voyais déjà en haut de l'affiche, en 10 fois plus gros que n'importe qui, mon nom s'étalait. Je me voyais déjà adulé et riche, signant mes photos aux admirateurs qui se bousculaient. J'étais le plus grand des grands fantaisistes, faisant un succès si fort que les gens m'acclamaient debout. Je me voyais déjà cherchant dans ma liste celle qui le soir pourrait par faveur se prendre à mon cou.
When Thanksgiving rolls around, Native American storyteller and historian Marge Bruchac gets a lot of requests to talk about the first Thanksgiving, when the English settlers got together with the Wampanoag natives of Massachusetts for a feast. The year was 1621. Bruchac co-authored the book, 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving. We continue our annual tradition of airing Bruchac's true story of Thanksgiving.
The entire myth of this event as the so-called first Thanksgiving, as this foundational moment in American history, is based on Edward Winslow's account of a 1621 autumn harvest feast, when he writes, "We set the last spring some 20 acres of Indian corn and sowed some 6 acres of barley and peas, and according to the manner of the Indians, we manured our ground with herrings, or rather shads, which we have in great abundance, and take with great ease at our doors. Our corn did prove well, and God be praised, we had a good increase of Indian corn, and our barley indifferent good, but our peas not worth the gathering." And he goes on to note that That was the first successful harvest they had had. And being that it was a good harvest, it was time to gather together and celebrate the harvest.
So why did they choose to invite the Indians, or did they choose
well, they
to invite
didn't.
The Indians?
That's the important. That's a very important detail people often miss. They did not say, let's have a harvest and invite the Indians. What they did is they started gathering all of this food, and then they decided to have some military maneuvers. And so what brought Massasoit is the fact that the Plymouth colonists, who, remember, had signed a peace treaty with Massasoit, were walking around firing off their guns, wearing their armor, and suddenly doing military maneuvers. So when Massasoit showed up with 90 men to investigate what's going on, you can tell from the records that he was suspicious. It's only after he arrives and realizes that it's a feast they're preparing for that he sends his men out, and they hunt four deer and bring them back. And so the largest quantity of food is not even this harvest that the colonists have brought in using native technology, using native styles of fertilizing and everything else to prepare the food.
You mean with the fish.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's not the bulk of the food. The bulk of the food is the deer and the corn and the native food that Massasoit and his people bring.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
You've shown us how the myth differs from the reality. Well, you've mm-hmm. shown us how the reality differs from the myth. And yet that myth is there. It's a very powerful one. What do you think that's about? If you have you done any thinking about why was this myth necessary? Why was it necessary for white Americans to create a myth of friendship with the peoples that they had conquered?
The important point to make is not there was friendship. There was a negotiated friendship. The myth implies that Native people had already vanished by that moment in time, and that the few Indians who were left were invited to a feast that the English hosted. So I think the nature of the myth gives the English a sense of dominance over the landscape and over the history at a moment in time when they were, in fact, struggling and starving and about to disappear themselves.
There's something about that one big happy family.
That, right, that's the mythical part, that one big happy multicultural family. That forgets the fact that this is native landscape. It forgets the fact that the Plymouth colony is very, very small. And the entire continent of North America, the entire continent of South America, is all Indian country. Even though there have been plagues, even though there has been contact, it's all Indian country. And so what often happens is that tiny little Plymouth colony hanging on for dear life on the coast is made to look much larger than it is in fact and is given so much more power than it has at that moment in time. And that power just extends across the continent with manifest destiny. And I think that's the danger of the myth. If it were a truer rendition of the story, you would start from the Wampanoag perspective of a long inhabited landscape, more than 12,000 years, and considering how you deal with this small band of strangers who enter into your landscape. And you would learn from the Wampanoag point of view that negotiation, reaching out, helping strangers is part of their way. And even little details like the first person to encounter the colonists is not Massasoit, it's Samoset, who is an Abenaki sachem. He's from north in what's now Maine. And he's traveled down to this territory, and he sees these people, and he knows who these people are. They've been taking captives from the coast for several decades now. There are more than 80 native people stolen from Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Wampanoag territory, all up and down the coast have already been taken back to England as captives. None of these native people are in awe at the arrival of the pilgrims, but they make a decision, and the decision they make on the spot is a negotiated peace. And I think that's what's lost in that myth of the happy family.
One of the reasons the English colonists survived is that the Wampanoag showed them how to grow corn. Marge Bruchak is a member of the Abenaki tribe. She told us her people's story of how they were given corn.
The story that we have in Abenaki territory talks about corn as a young woman who comes in the middle of winter during a starving time. And when she comes to the people, she's very tall and very lean. She has a long green dress that rustles when she walks. And she asks for a place to stay through the winter. And the people take her in, and they give her room in a lodge, and she sleeps with four grandmothers. And she spends the whole winter with the people. And through that winter, she can't speak their language, but she learns a few words. She listens to the story. She watches how the old care for the young and how the young care for the old. And when spring comes, she gathers those people together. And she says to them that she is grateful for the way they have cared for her, even though she is a stranger. She's grateful for the way they have treated her like a sister. And she has a gift to give to them. And she tells them to give them this gift, she will have to die. And the people say, oh no, sister, you don't have to die. We have good medicine people. We can cure you. And she says, no, no. When I die, you will take my body and you will lay it in your fields. You will pile the earth over it and you will watch that place and my gift will come to you. And so with heavy hearts, the people do as they have been asked to do, and they take that woman's body and they lay it in the fields and they pile the earth over it and they watch and they wait. And when spring comes on, a small green plant grows out of that place, and it is just the color of that woman's green dress. And it keeps growing. And as that plant gets a little taller, it has leaves that come out and they rustle the way that woman's dress used to rustle when she walked. And the plant keeps growing. And when it gets to be as tall as that woman was tall, it grows seed pods on the side. And from each of those seed pods is hanging long strands of sandy brown hair, like that woman's hair. And when they peel open the seed pods, there is the gift. And this is the food she gives to them. And so the people right away, they give thanks, Bemkikta, Kikta, Olioni, to the earth and sky for helping that plant to grow. They give thanks to that woman for coming to them. They give thanks to all of the grandmothers for looking after that woman like she was their own kin. And there's a song that goes along with that. It's called the Green Corn Song. And it's usually sung in four parts, thanking the four grandmothers that looked after that woman. And it kind of goes like this. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Olalike kwe wanneo. Olalike kwe wanneo. Olalike kwe wanneo.
Marge Bruschak is an anthropologist, historian, and museum consultant. In addition to 1621, she's the author of other books, including the children's book Malian Song. She's also a performer of Algonquian Indian music and oral traditions. Let's hear a song by Marge Bruschak from her album Voices in the Woods, Abenaki Indian Songs and Stories. The song is called Mothers.
Aum ba da da, aum ba da da, brought us into this earth, the mother gave us life and birth, gave us life and birth, the mother. Just what they know, the mothers will watch us grow. All the four-legged ones will watch us grow. All the water-bound ones will watch us grow. The winged ones will watch us grow. watch us grow. All the mothers will watch us grow. The mothers brought us into this earth, brought us into this earth. The mothers gave us life and birth, gave us life and birth. The mothers teach us what they know,
teach us
what they know. The mothers will watch us grow with their loving hands. They'll watch us grow with their loving hearts. They'll watch us grow. The mothers will watch us grow. Just grow. The mother will watch us grow.
Marge Bruschak singing Mothers on her album Voices in the Woods. Well, before we go, there is one last thing, a short clip from a new series we're starting at our website called What You Need to Know. We're starting it because at the dawn of the Trump era, we feel it's important to counteract all the fake news and propaganda that led to this moment and that seems to be gaining ascendancy in the national discourse. We'll be posting interviews on the site with experts talking about important topics in the news. This week, I spoke with Nancy Altman of Social Security Works about her recent article in Huffington Post, Medicare will be gone by next Thanksgiving if Republicans have their way.
This is really no joke. There is a process in Congress called reconciliation. The Republicans have control of the House. They have a majority in the Senate. They have the White House. In the Senate, unless they get rid of the filibuster, there is the filibuster, so that the Democrats could stop this. The problem is that they will use this little-known process known as reconciliation. That's what they're talking about doing. And that, they only need a majority. It cannot be blocked. It's fast-tracked. And that's what they're talking about doing. They're using the excuse that they're going to use it to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and that had some provisions about Medicare, but they're using it as a contrivance to get at Medicare, which they have never liked.
Listen to the whole interview with Nancy Altman at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.